531.
Time for our weekly wrap-up of global politics with Dr. Stephen Hoagley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. This afternoon, Dr. Stephen, a court case to begin with in Wisconsin in the United States reveals a lot about US politics. Tell us more.
Yes, good to be with you this afternoon, Brian, and Radio 531 PI listeners. The faraway state of Wisconsin had a trial of a man named Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old who carried an automatic rifle into a demonstration, shot dead two people, and wounded a third. And he was found not guilty. He pleaded self-defense. Well, this has set off a firestorm of protest. And on both sides of this debate, we know that the Republicans favor easy gun laws. We know that the Democrats are trying to rein in guns in the United States. Well, the Rittenhouse decision has meant that gun owners are empowered. They are buying guns in unprecedented numbers. They're buying ammunition. They are buying ghost guns and kit guns. They're buying braces that turn handguns into virtual rifles, and it is a real setback for those who would like to rein in the abuse of firearms in the United States. It's become partisan, it's become political, if it wasn't already, and this has set back progressive democratic notions of restricting gun use and trying to reduce the number of gun homicides and accidental deaths in the United States. So it's a bad precedent. Is there any appeal? No, he's been tried and found to be innocent. But there can be a civil proceedings. That is, the families of the two people, of the three who were killed and injured, can bring a civil case, as they did against O.J. Simpson, who killed his ex-wife. And O.J. eventually was found guilty in civil court and had to pay millions of dollars in damages. So the court cases are not over, but this unfortunate precedent has been set in American politics. Brian?
Russia in the news again. What's the latest out of the East?
Well, two things, Brian. First of all, in outer space, the Russians have shot a missile up to destroy one of their own satellites. Well, the Western powers believe this is really a test of how the Russians could knock out Western and U.S. satellites. As we know, the system of communication, of weather reporting, of surveillance is dependent on satellite reconnaissance, and the Russians are specializing in satellite killing. Well, this could be a destabilizing movement, because not only does it show that the Russians are able to do this, but it does increase the amount of space junk that is floating around and become a hazard to other space vehicles. The other thing the Russians are doing is massing their troops on the border with Ukraine. As you know, in 2014, the Russians took over Crimea and moved into eastern Ukraine, and it's feared that this troop buildup, which has been warned by the United States, could threaten Ukraine again. Now, Ukraine is responding by calling for help. It wants NATO to support it. It's not a member, but it needs support. The British government and the French government have each separately said they will support Ukraine. The United States stands behind Ukraine. Secretary of State has visited there. And the Russians say, look, this is provocative. It is NATO-izing Ukraine on the Russian border. And the Russians complain that American warships operate in the Black Sea. Well, the Black Sea is international water, and the Americans have every right to be there. But I suppose the Russians do have a point that they feel threatened. Is this all saber-rattling? Is it just to build Putin's failing reputation in Russia as a savior of his country? Or is this a serious clandestine move that it will allow the Russians and the Russian-speaking Ukrainians to take over larger tracts of the Ukrainian population? Well, we shall see, but keep your eye on this story, Brian.
What's the latest with Russia's ally Belarus on another border there with regards to the migrant situation?
Well, Belarus is a naughty country in the sense that, first of all, they have welcomed Russian exercises, paratroop exercises, overflight by Russian nuclear-armed bombers. And the latest, as we talked about last week, is that they have weaponized by inviting refugees from the Middle East to fly into Belarus via Turkish Airlines or Emirates Airlines. And then they are bused to the border, where they are urged to try to break through into Poland, that is, to enter the European Union jurisdiction. Well, the European Union quickly branded this as an attempt by Belarus to destabilize the European Union by sending these undocumented migrants into their jurisdiction, and accused Russia of giving that support. As well, Belarus has threatened to reduce the gas flow into Europe that passes from Russia into Europe. Particularly during the winter, this gas is necessary for heating and for power. And so there's a number of issues at play here. And some people think that maybe this is Russia's attempt, both in Ukraine and in Belarus, to bring pressure on the Europeans to encourage them to approve of a gas pipeline directly from Russia, which will be very lucrative, so Russia can sell more gas to the Europeans. So there are many, many issues at play here, and it's just one of these stories that continues to unfold. As far as we know, the refugees, they're migrants. They're not yet designated as refugees. They're migrants. About 400 of them have returned home. That is, the Iraqi government has offered them flights back to their home country, and a few, maybe 10%, have taken up that option. The others are now housed in a warehouse. They're not starving, and they're not freezing as they were before, but the Polish authorities continue to be vigilant, feeling that the Belarus security officers are, in fact, encouraging these migrants to break through the fence in Poland and to violate Poland's jurisdiction. Brian?
Now, last week we talked about tennis diplomacy with regards to the disappearance of Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai. What's the latest?
Well, Peng Shuai has been seen on videos, but there's a lot of skepticism. The International Olympic Committee boss has spoken with her and says, look, she's fine, she just wants her privacy. But the World Tennis, the Women's Tennis Association, has expressed a lot more concern, saying, look, the initial accusation that she made of sexual violation by a high-ranking Chinese official has not been acknowledged. We cannot get a hold of her. We can't talk to her. So in some respects, the International Olympic Committee, that's dominated by men, has said, look, there's no problem. And, of course, the Chinese government says there's no problem. But the Women's Tennis Association, which has a much greater input of women, is saying, look, there is a problem, and this is an unresolved issue. So at the moment, we don't quite know which of the stories is correct. We hope that a fuller accounting will be taking place. But we know from last week's discussion, Brian, that some 30,000 people have disappeared in China over the last decade, and that this is not an uncommon tactic for the government to simply remove somebody from circulation, to cancel their Twitter account, which has happened in the tennis player's case, and later on they will be put on trial for disturbing the peace or threatening tranquility or some other charge that we regard as quite trivial. Or they may not be seen for years, as in the case of the former Chinese head of Interpol, who has been missing now for 4 years, and his wife, who's taken refuge in Europe, continues to campaign. So we hope that Ms. Peng will turn up and be unharmed, but it certainly raises a number of questions about the way the government of China conducts its policy towards its citizens, Brian.
And finally, the British Virgin Islands considering dumping the Queen as head of state. Why and what sort of precedent, if any, will it set for our Pacific Island neighbours, Dr. Stephen?
Well, this is a really interesting case. That British Virgin Islands is, along with Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, and several others, regarded as a tax haven. There are some, by one estimate, 400,000 companies are registered in British Virgin Islands. They pay minimal tax, minimal scrutiny. They can carry out their activities and move their assets around in this and a number of other tax havens identified by the European Union. And so the government of British Virgin Islands has said, why don't we leave the Commonwealth and leave the Queen's jurisdiction if they're going to investigate our activities. So they obviously want to maintain this free status in the face of an inquiry that the British government would like to conduct into their financial affairs. Well, how other governments as well have done the same thing. Grenada, for example, Barbados, have left the jurisdiction of the Queen for similar reasons, and the European Union has identified American Samoa, Guam, Marshall Islands, Palau, and Samoa as also tax havens. So there is some implication that these also may come under scrutiny. Well, it won't really affect their relationship with the Queen because only Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, and Tuvalu still recognize the Queen as head of state. But it does put the spotlight on certain Pacific Islands to make sure that their conduct of international financial affairs is above board, that they will comply with the new agreement by the OECD, led by the United States, to create a minimum 15% taxation on multinational corporations so that tax havens will become obsolete. And this may eventually clear up the problem. But this is something worth watching. Is what's happening in the Caribbean these days, does it set precedents for the Pacific Islands? Brian?
Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts, Another wrap-up of Global Politics. Thank you as always, Dr. Stephen. We'll catch up again next Wednesday. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you, Brian.